Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Money and Markets. This is John Titus and Catherine Alston Fitz for the Solera Report. We are recording on Wednesday, the 12th, for publication tomorrow on the 13th. John, our theme is?
Find out who your friends are.
Yeah. Survival depends. Thriving depends on knowing who your friends are. And every time I turn and look at these stories, I see people embracing their enemies. We gotta
right.
learn how to protect ourselves.
Right. Your enemy's enemy, not necessarily your friend. Right. A lot yes. of good stories this week. We get into some nuts and bolts and some stories without getting into the weeds. I think it's a good mix of yeah. interesting stories this week.
Right.
Anyway.
Although you see, they're great stories. I was going through them just now before we got on, and you see how gruesome the implementation of technocracy can be.
Boy, do you ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's serious, and that's why the theme, you got to know who your friends are.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, let's just get into it with...
Speaking of a friend.
You were going to start with John Mearsheimer.
Isn't he great? I love this guy.
He's a professor of international relations at University of Chicago, just kind of an old school sort of historian who gives this summary about what's going on in the world. We'll lead off with genocide in Gaza. He touches on Gaza, but he touches on other things too. But let's just see what he has to say. This is just a completely tight and apt summary.
He's a very clear thinker.
Yeah.
So I think things are only going to get worse. I don't think most people understand how much trouble we're in. As I tried to make clear, I think the Russians will win in Ukraine. I think this will have negative consequences for Europe. It'll do significant damage to NATO. I think that nationalism is a growing force around the world. I think the liberal regimes that dominated during the unipolar moment in Europe are in trouble. I think if you look at the American domestic political situation, especially with regard to what's happening with Donald Trump and how he thinks about democracy, I think it's quite clear that the United States is in trouble. With regard to the Middle East, I think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is only going to get worse. The idea that the Israelis are in the process of fixing this problem, I don't think is true. There's no solution to Gaza at the moment.
Yep.
That about says it all. Notice that it comes sort of implicit in what he says there. He seems to think Donald Trump is headed for the White House.
So I think he thinks Donald Trump is headed for the White House, and that is not going to be good for America.
Right. Right. His ideas about democracy. I'm working on a video now about central bank independence. And there's a right answer and a wrong answer on central bank independence. The right answer is, U.S. Constitution. The wrong answer is the European way, which Joe Biden's advocating. And then there's Donald Trump, not the constitutional way, the Donald Trump way.
Donald Trump is promoting the digital ID and more central control, and is phenomenally supportive of the people who want central digital financial control.
Right.
I mean, if you look at who he's supporting, not what he's saying, but who he's supporting, same as Bobby, they're supporting the people who want total central control. And Trump is very aggressive about wanting a biometric and digital ID, and all the border is completely biometric control.
He's also very aggressive about expanding Article 2 power well beyond Article 2. He wants to take over Article 3 and Article 1. He wants the powers of a king.
Right.
Completely in disregard of the Constitution. Where I sit, I'm going to lay that out.
Right.
And it's dangerous because his version of central bank independence is guaranteed legally to fail, which is going to leave you with the Biden version, which is as bad or worse. It's not good, but that's what Mearsheimer says, and he's right. There's trouble around the world, and there's no good answer anywhere.
Right. Now, the one thing I will say is if you look at what the U.S. is proposing to do by moving more military into Europe, if you're the United States and the empire and you want to cannibalize Europe to keep your game going, you know, there is that benefit to the NATO crew. This is going to give them more power to move in and have more Anglo-American alliance dominance of Europe. And why Europe let it happen?
I don't know, but they've essentially been relegated to not even really the status of a colony, the vassalage over there.
Right. If you look at the fight that they're having in the Swedish parliament right now, you know, they're fighting over whether or not they're going to approve the agreement they signed in December with the Americans. And it's a military occupation of Sweden. And Sweden will absolutely be colonized.
Yes.
Right.
You got it.
Right. And the Swedish, many of the Swedish are behaving like America's their friend.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They're going to find out who their friends are.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Your enemy's enemy's not your friend.
Right.
Let's keep it going in war in Gaza. And this next clip is from an American living in Palestine. But I want a vocabulary word first. Aquifer. We're going to see this word more than once in this episode. We're going to hear it in the next video clip. Aquifer is a water-bearing stratum of permeable rock, sand, or gravel on which, you know, water sources are often built. Anyway, so let's listen to this young mother in Palestine talking about what it's like over there.
My name is Morgan Cooper. I'm a U.S. citizen married to a Palestinian. We're raising our two small children here in Ramallah of occupied Palestine. It's 4 in the morning, and I'm on our roof to check our water supply. Because we don't have water. We didn't have water for 2 days this week, and somehow that feels really weird and inappropriate to complain about or talk about when you look at the absolute annihilation of life in Gaza that is through using food and water both as weapons. And I have a WhatsApp this morning telling me that the Israeli authorities, and before somebody comments that the PA should provide our water, the Israeli settlements were built on 2 of the main aquifers of the West Bank, and our water is confiscated, our wells and our water sources are intentionally destroyed by the occupation, so they confiscate all of the water, they ration it and sell it back to us. And I just read that our water supply has been cut by over 50%. And at a normal time, I get my water from Tuesday, Wednesday to Thursday. And this week I got water one evening and I have one tank and it's gone. Life is untenable under occupation.
Yeah. Life without water is untenable. Yep. And that's been going on, by the way. This didn't start October 7th last year. That's been going on for decades. The restriction of water by the Israeli settlers.
I saw a very serious one-hour presentation in the early 2000s in London at an investment firm about how, you know, the Israeli and the move and the occupation was to get the water, and how water was almost as big an issue as the oil and gas in Israel. And I'd forgotten that. I'd seen that until I saw this video and was reminded that water is a big issue here.
Yeah, it's a big issue in Gaza, and it's becoming a big issue in the U.S. It's going to come up again in this episode.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, remember, we talked last week about the water system in Atlanta.
Yep. Yeah. That's exactly right. This is an entirely different set of fact structure, although ultimately the problem may be coming from the same source. We'll talk about that later when we get to it.
And when I bought my house in 2006 in Tennessee, one absolute requirement is I had to have my own well.
Yeah.
I had to have my own well.
That was one nice thing about Indiana was, you know, in rural areas, it was well water.
Right.
Yep. She mentions the PA, Palestinian Authority.
Right.
You know, anyway, let's keep it going. Not all as well if you're on the Israeli side either. That's this next story. Let's take a look at this from the cradle. Economic boycott of Israel already here, according to a report. A senior Israeli banking executive said that the current war in Gaza is driving investors to withdraw their funds from the Israeli economy. Quote, we are becoming economically unwelcome, almost pariahs in some areas. Many companies are now at risk as international entities impose an informal boycott on Israeli companies and factories, avoiding investments here, he said. The government must immediately develop an emergency plan to rescue business entities from a situation that could become a genuine threat to the stability of the Israeli economy. In times of war, we need strategies not only to eliminate figures like Sinwar, though that is certainly important, but also to protect and sustain some of Israel's major economic enterprise, as well as small businesses, which are being hurt now over there.
Well, wow. It's interesting because I've gotten reports of money pouring in because of all the U.S. aid. But at the same time, I think if you look at the anger towards Israel and the, I would say, the irrationality of the leadership, you can see why countries around the world and businesses would want to avoid the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's like have you ever seen the cartoons of the herd that slowly moves away from the diseased animal?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'll point out something else, though. You mentioned it. The money is pouring in, okay? Certainly it's pouring in, but it's a lot like QE, if you think about it.
Right. It's healthy money.
It's not only not healthy money, it's crony money.
Right.
Do you think that money pouring into Israel is going to small businesses?
No. Mm-hmm. It's racket money. And what it does is it centralizes control in the war machine.
Right.
But the productive stuff pulls away. But I don't think it's just productive small business. I think you've got a lot of big corporations who are doing business around the globe, and they are going to run into serious marketing trouble. Because if you have your choice of three great companies, IT contractors, and one of them is from a country that's highly controversial in your client base, who needs that? You got two other guys you can pick from.
Right. Right. Exactly. So I don't doubt that the professor there at all, or the banking executive in that article, you know, small businesses are getting hurt over there.
Right.
The war in Gaza is not, it's benefiting one group and it's harming another group.
Right.
It's genuine warfare and it's genuine genocide against Gazans, against Palestinians. But it's economic warfare against kind of the small guys in Israel, you know?
Right. And but I don't think this is just the small guys, John. I think you're watching a leadership which is not adult. And businesses love rational leadership. They love, you know, they love an environment where they can do business. And the clear message of the leadership in Israel and the United States is, you know, this is not under adult jurisdiction. What's going on here is not under adult, and you can't plan ahead, and you can't, you know, this is not a comfortable environment for business, even big companies.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Israel is in very serious trouble.
That's the implication from a banking executive, you know, who's in a position to know.
Right.
Yeah, you're gonna have to start taking measures. This thing has dragged out a long time now. You know, it's 8 months.
If you look at what Mearsheimer is just, how do you pronounce his name?
Mearsheimer.
If you look at what Mearsheimer just said, he just said there's no end in sight. They don't have a plan.
Right.
In other words, this could go on for years. I mean, the clear message, if you look at it, is we're planning. If Egypt won't take them, we're going to just kill them and take the land and the water and the oil and gas, and that's it. You know, but by the time they finish doing that, and you can accelerate a lot with famine and, you know, stealing the water, they're going to be the pariahs of the global stage.
Absolutely.
I don't see how they get away with this.
Absolutely. Not only that, but the IDF is young kids. How many youngins? I mean, they're 18. You know, they got like 19-year-old corporals over there.
So there was an editorial in the Financial Times this week by a very successful U.S. business person saying, you know, Israel's our business too, and Netanyahu has to go. So when the AIPAC crowd starts calling for Netanyahu's dismissal, you know something's up.
I'll believe that when I see it. I've heard the Netanyahu must go tune too many times. I'm not one of these people who had to watch Charlie Brown 5,000 times to figure out he wasn't going to kick the football.
Right. No, I'm not. You know, yeah. Netanyahu is there because he's doing the Empire spitting.
He's been around a long time.
Right.
He's been around since before 9/11.
Right.
Not going anywhere. But,
yeah, but what that tells me is you have a certain constituency in the U.S. that's starting to realize they have a problem. Because if you look, so Massey was on Tucker Carlson last week or earlier this week and basically outed AIPAC and the whole Israeli game and did it in a very funny, charming way. And for the first time in the last 4 weeks, I've seen the worm turn on AIPAC and dual passport citizenship. You know, people are now talking about it and admitting this is a real problem and it's got to stop. And I think the Americans in that crowd are realizing, you know, this is causing us real problems.
Yeah. It's been causing problems for a long time.
Right. Well, but they've been getting away with it for a long time. And now people are starting to realize, you know, if you look at the influence that that group has had on Congress, you can't allow that anymore or the country's over.
And by the way, Mearsheimer is one of the guys who has written and been writing on this for decades.
He wrote a great piece in a great book in 2005 on Israeli influence, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, he's writing books on AIPAC.
Well, but 20 years ago, because I heard him when he first published that book, he was warning, if you don't stop this, it's going to destroy the country. He wouldn't have said it that way. That's my more blunt version of what he said. But he basically said, if you don't stop this, you can destroy the country. And he was right.
He is right. Which begs the question of whether destroying the U.S. is part of the plan. And I'm beginning to wonder.
It certainly appears to be.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
It's plausible. You can't, I would, you know, a year ago, I would have dismissed that out of hand. Now I'm not so sure.
No, I think they absolutely want to break up the country.
Yeah, I wonder. There are certain features, I'm doing this video on central bank independence. There are certain features of central bank independence that are unique to the U.S. and they're better than anywhere else.
Right.
One of which is transparency. And I know the Fed had been audited, all the rest, but believe it or not, there's more transparency into the Federal Reserve.
The Fed is audited.
Yes, exactly.
They have an auditor.
The GAO, right.
No, they have private auditors. When I had Pricewaterhouse auditing the FHA and doing very illegal criminal things, in my opinion, they were also doing the Fed. Because remember, the profits...
Are those audits published publicly?
I would say there's published financials. I doubt it's the full financials. And I doubt it includes things like the Exchange Stabilization Fund and what the New York Fed is up to as depository.
Right.
So
there's more transparency into the Fed. My point simply being there's more public transparency into the Fed than there is in any other central bank in the world.
That's good. I don't know that, but that's a good, if you say so, I believe you.
Oh, for sure. Congress can get what it wants from the Fed when it wants to. It's proven that time and again. It's just muscle that doesn't get exercised enough.
Right.
Okay. Let's move to Ukraine. Then we're getting to some counting. What we want to count is dead bodies, grim as it is, and how long this war is going to go on. And
you know, a part of the count in the Ukraine is people who've left and gone to Europe.
Okay. Whether they're missing or whether they're dead.
Right.
Whether they've gone, they've left the country or they've left the earth. They're not going to be fighting on behalf of Ukraine.
Right.
Right. And that's the kind of what we're going to look at right now. First one is a Polish army chief, Ukraine losing war to Russia, says former Polish army chief. More than 10 million people are missing. So he's looked at population data and he's like, something doesn't add up here.
And this is two months ago. This is 2 months ago. Right.
It's March. Right. Retired General Andrijak expressed his belief that Ukraine is losing the war. He says more than 10 million people are missing. According to, in other words, the population rolls don't jive with what I'm seeing. According to my estimates, losses, meaning dead bodies in the Ukraine war, losses should be in the millions, if I'm to credit the population figures, not hundreds of thousands. The country has no resources, no one to fight. Ukrainians are losing this war. So what he's saying there is either these soldiers are dead in the millions, or tens of millions of people have just left the country.
Right.
They're not around.
Right.
But there's no one left to fight.
Right.
Okay? What he doesn't get into is how long that gives Ukraine left in this war. And that brings us to the next piece by Simplicius, who we've had several times on Money Markets. Putin gives first official idea of Russian losses since the start of the special military operation. Let's just cut to the chase. He goes through some analysis and then he gives us this. Given that 500,000 figure, and here he's talking to 500,000 refers to the number of dead Ukrainian soldiers. Given that the 500,000 figure is an official Russian military of defense figure, which Putin would not contradict, we can only assume that Russian losses are therefore about one-fifth of that, which would be 100,000, because Putin came out and said in his speech, the ratio of dead is 5-1 in our favor in this war. That's interesting, Simplicius tells us, because the official U.S. casualty number for Russia is something like 350,000 counting. And if you count lightly wounded people, they're not maimed or seriously, they could come back. This may well, the 350,000 figure may actually be relatively accurate. So where does this leave us? And so we got to go way down to here. And he says, at the current burn rate of 30,000 per month, that's 30,000 per month Ukrainian soldiers killed, it would take 33 months or about 2.5 years to whittle down their male combat potential. But if you use another figure, it would take a mere 23 months, so about 2 years. And then we get this from Putin. Putin says that the U.S. administration is now pressuring Ukraine to lower mobilization age all the way down to 18, and most critically, that they only need Zelensky as a scapegoat to pass the law to do that. Once they force him to lower it to 18, they'll get rid of him. Putin even gives the exact timeline. He believes it will take about a year from today by next spring before they will boot Zelensky out. So between a year and 2 years, and this is a done deal.
Right. So they've pulled the passports. What they're saying is they won't renew passports of Ukrainians who've left who are military age. And so you've got to come back. So they're trying to pull back some of the folks who fled to Europe. Obviously, they're not going to get an amazing amount of fled to Russia.
Yep.
So, and the Russians have offered passports to Ukrainians who are coming over.
Do you know that they fled to Russia? I don't doubt that, but I don't have any way.
I've just seen coverage that looks reliable with, you know, with numbers saying what the Russians have reported, but that's it.
Anecdotally, I've seen that to be true in videos of Ukrainian soldiers surrendering, but I don't speak Russian or Ukrainian.
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah, right. I do Twitter know the feeds. Russians offered citizenship.
That I know, yes.
Right.
But whether it's the acceptance that I'm not sure about.
Right.
For well, sure, the offer's on the table.
You know, most people have gone to Europe, not to Russia. So
that's what I would guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what I would guess. Yeah. So that's interesting. You know, when we when this broke out in February 2 years ago, so really 2.25 years ago, you and I said, you know, buckle your seatbelt. This is going to be a while. You know, remember a couple of weeks ago,
right,
maybe a week ago, we saw generals in the U.S. saying, oh, it's going to be over in 10 days. We have to sew this baby up. We'll be out of there about 10 days, 2 weeks, done deal. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
So I'll put a review up on the website. Probably next week. I just finished reading a book. I'll hold it up, called The Russian Art of War. There's a French reporter who's covered the conventional war very, very carefully. And he wrote a book, and it doesn't include all of the sort of covert operations we've talked about, money laundering through the Ukraine or the bio labs. It's just the straight conventional war. And it's an amazing and very detailed description. And it simply goes into the details of what you and I have been talking about, which is Russia's been running a third generation conventional land war, and they've been organizing it to win the land war according to what their stated objectives are. Ukraine has been running a media war and trying to win in the media, And as a result, the Ukrainians, the Russians are very, very careful to avoid deaths. And so they're trying to achieve their stated goals. They're not trying to take land. They're trying to protect deaths and inflict the most casualties on the Ukrainians they possibly can for any effort. And so so they're winning. I mean, they're slaughtering the Ukrainians. And you, if you read it, what you realize is the worst job you could possibly have over the last 2 years is to be a Ukrainian general, because you're not allowed to run the war to win the war. You have to run the war, you know, to win Zelensky's media war. And that's just going to get everybody killed. And that, you know, that's operating in the short run and losing in the long run. And basically, it's basically, you know, I hate to say it, it's a real army against poodles.
Yes.
And it's, you know, and you read it and you think, is the real goal just to depopulate the Ukraine? I couldn't come up with a better plan to depopulate the Ukraine.
Right, and depopulate the male, the young male portion of the Ukraine.
Right, if you want to invade and colonize and take over all the assets, who do you want to get rid of? You want to get rid of the, you know, the army and the young men who can stop that.
The demographic most likely to and most able to rebel.
Right.
Right. I mean, revolution is an inherently a young male act.
Right.
You know, you looked at the founding fathers; they're all in their 30s, basically. I mean, there's some variance, but they're not much.
Right.
You know.
Right. So you read this and it's frightening. It's just, it's a frightening. And he's not trying to frighten you. It's very factual. It's very just matter of a fact.
Anyway. You know, what is exactly right, though. They're running a media war over there. I can't tell you how many times I read a story. It reminds me, it's like listening to my dad bitching. You know, he was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Marine Corps on the front. And he was constantly bitching about Robert McNamara and these decisions made, not military decisions.
Right.
But, you know, they're PR, I think he called it.
Well, but if you look at what he describes of the, you know, sort of the conventional, the real army against the poodles, you know, you've seen that all the way along. You saw that very early and you've been on it the whole way across. And I think my question for you is, how did you see that early that it was that ridiculous?
Because the Russians have been steadily, they face real adversaries.
Right.
We really don't. We're a bully. We pick on people who don't have weapons, who wear sandals, and they're largely agrarian. You know, Vietnamese, people in Afghanistan.
Right.
We're good at slaughtering civilians.
Right.
The Russians, they take on real armies.
Right.
And one of the themes that we've seen again and again in money markets is that they get this real-time feedback loop where they keep getting better.
Right.
Right? They've been at this game of real-time feedback loops with weapon systems and improving weapon systems on the fly for a long time now, for basically a generation. That's a real army taking on people who've really
thought. Right, but they've been very disciplined about saying, we're going to play the legitimacy game in international law, but other than that, we're not going to worry about the media. We're going to focus and win the land war. And we're going to, you know, Lavrov and Putin are going to be willing to take the tomatoes and not waste energy or time refuting the tomatoes.
It's another difference is they've got real diplomats. They have real statesmen over there.
Right.
You know, and we've got poodles, like you say. We've got Anthony Blinken, for crying out loud.
Right. We'll get to St. Petersburg, but if you look at the recent St. Petersburg summit that they've had, unfortunately, I think the reverberation back from the world is very much working in their favor. And I hate to say it, we've earned the loss.
Yeah, we really have. Let me ask you this before we turn to FedWatch, because it'll lead us into FedWatch. How much money do you think the U.S. has spent on the Ukrainian war?
I don't think we know the truth because there's so much.
100 billion?
Oh, more. Much more.
Okay.
Much more. And here's the problem, John. I don't know how much money is going through Ukraine to send weapons around the world for the rackets. And I don't know how much is laundering back to the United States.
Okay. What would the powers that be admit to? 100 billion, rough ballpark?
I think they'll admit to 100. Well, this last package was 100 billion.
Was it? I thought it was 60. So, anyway.
Well, but I think the number, if you include the throughput numbers, it's more than double that.
Okay. All right. Let's go to the next story. This is FedWatch. This is a crazy story. We're in FedWatch now. It's about nuclear reactor, of all things. Take a look at some of these numbers. I had to read this story twice. Washington looking to revive more shuttered nuclear plants. Okay. The Biden administration may move to reverse the retirement of some additional nuclear power plants in a last-ditch effort to increase the supply of zero-emissions energy, following a March loan to reopen a reactor in Michigan. Okay, so the principal actor here in this is U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. Why would you want to revive a reactor? Well, because the cost of building a new nuclear reactor is time-consuming and expensive. So revive them, don't build new ones. It's cheaper. Okay, the move follows the March decision by the Department of Energy to issue a $1.52 billion loan to Hotel International to finance the restart of a Michigan-based Palisades reactor, which was shuttered only recently, 2022. So it's only been shut for 2 years, and it's going to cost you $1.5 billion to start to fire it back up.
So if you look at that company, it was hired to shut it down. So yeah. Entergy owned it, and it was moved to hotel, and they were given money to shut it down. Now, I want you to understand that is a private company who also runs the old Chernobyl site, I think, and has a subsidiary in Ukraine. So we're talking about a company that's doing nuclear energy in the Ukraine. Anyway, right. And now they've decided, okay, well, we'll pay them even more money and see if they can get it started again.
Okay.
And so let's keep going.
Let's just the tab right now. Right, one, revive power plants, 2 years. It's only been shut 2 years to revive at $1.5 billion, okay, so far. Right. Let's keep going. Granholm indicated to Reuters that there is a strong possibility that the Department of Energy's loan program was already in talk with other nuclear power plants that have been shuttered. Those that have been in a state of decommissioning for a longer period will be more difficult and expensive, if not impossible, to restart, according to Reuters. Some 12 nuclear reactors have been shut down since 2013. So even at $1.50 a throw, you got 12 of them. You know, now you're looking at $18 billion.
Right.
But we know it's going to be north of $18 billion because they've been shut longer and it's more expensive. But let's keep it going. We're at $18 billion so far since we got 12 of them. While Granholm remained tight-lipped as to what other shuttered nuclear power plants could be in store for a revival, she noted that there are some 30 power plants in the U.S. that are at some point in the process of permitting for new reactors, which are going to be more than $1.5 billion, right?
Right.
So you're looking now that just the new ones are probably $45 billion or up,
right,
plus $20 billion. We're sitting at $65 billion right now.
Right.
What is going on here?
So what is going on is that the U.S. infrastructure has not been maintained. And when I say maintain, not only are you, I mean, maintaining the Atlanta water system, but
yeah,
building the capacity to match the population and what's going on in the world.
Yeah. It's going to be expensive.
No, it's going to be triage.
But I don't think it's going to be that expensive. That's something's wrong with those numbers.
I don't know. I don't know enough about nuclear engineering to know. But I mean, would the government pad those figures to send money to their friends? Of course they would.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, well, what are we doing when Zelensky gets booted? We need something else. I got it.
Forget nuclear energy. You think nuclear energy? Really? Well, you know something? That's an interesting idea because they do need a new throughput.
It reminded me of, so Ukraine, nuclear energy may not be the total answer for the heavy hitter Ukraine, but you could probably rebuild the Ukraine funding through other things. So nuclear plus climate change, which we'll get to in a minute,
right?
Plus other boondoggles.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, John. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, what I was thinking is they're really pinched. You know, the AI and control grid need more energy. You know, they didn't anticipate, or they appear not to have anticipated, how much energy they need. Although one of the questions is, was Fink over yapping about he needs more energy because, in fact, they need a new game?
Very good question.
Right.
Why is a $10 trillion asset manager over there running his mouth if he doesn't need a new game? I think you're right. I think they need a new game.
Okay, so, that's worth thinking about.
Anyway, so something to think about. Now let's
turn
to...
They do need a new game. They do need a new game.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. Ukraine is looking more and more spent. Let's turn to water in the U.S., though. This next story is fascinating. Okay. State official issues water curtailment order for many eastern Idaho users. Okay? Idaho Department of Water Resources Director Matthew Weaver issued a curtailment order Thursday afternoon that requires 6,400 junior groundwater rights holders who pump off the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer, there's that word again, to shut off their water. Another player in this story is Idaho Governor Brad Little. We'll get to him in a minute. In a statement released Thursday night, Idaho groundwater appropriators criticized the order, which it described as the single largest curtailment of water use in state history. They say the order would dry up hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland and could cause a hit to the state's economy, totaling hundreds of millions of dollars in economic losses. That's serious. Quote, what remains is an utterly absurd situation where hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland and their associated economic benefits are thrown away, goodness, during a wet year to cause a small amount of additional water to overflow from the aquifer into the Snake River, the groundwater appropriator said in a written statement. So what we need to know in this is what junior rights are, what we're going to talk about. Water rights in Idaho are governed by what is referred to as a doctrine of prior appropriation, which means first in time, first in right. When there isn't enough water to go around, which we know there is because it's a wet year, water rights holders get their water first, and junior water rights holders get shut off or curtailed when there is not enough water to go around, which there is. So what's going on? And then the article drops this little nugget. California, not Idaho, California, where the federal government stepped in to supersede the state's control of water, the governor said, Governor Little said in his written statement, we absolutely must conserve water for future generations. So this sounds to me, this isn't coming from Idaho. This is coming. No, this is federal.
This is Fed. The feds, there have been articles about Fed pressuring the state. But what's interesting is they've been trying to get the farmers to sign these agreements and they won't. And what it looks like to me is this is part of the pressure. Because understand, my understanding from someone out there is the farmers have planted. It's one thing to cut off somebody's water before they plant. Once they spend an enormous investment of time and money to plant, and then you cut off their water.
Yeah.
You know, so somebody's right. Squeezing them. And the question is, what's it about? So I'm trying to find out more from people out in Idaho, and I just have more to research.
Yeah, we need some on-the-ground intel about what's going on out there. But I think there's a pretty big hint in that story. The pressure is definitely federal. The governor is like, oh, we gotta save this water. It's like, where is that coming from?
So, but I'm just telling everybody, whether you're in Atlanta, whether you're in Palestine, whether you're in Idaho, where's your water coming from? And how do you make sure that it's not going to get interrupted?
Okay, let's keep it going in FedWatch. And let's move from water rights to the climate scam.
This is so, you know, I feel like I'm watching one of the old World Bank IMF scams. It's just, or the Ex-Im Bank. It never changes. You know, we're here to help you. Here's the money. We'll put you in debt. And then you have to buy everything from us at inflated prices. What's new?
I don't know. It's watching a horror film. Guy walks in with a hockey mask and a flannel shirt. with the chainsaw, blood's coming off the chainsaw, and people are like, yeah, sign me up.
Yeah, Chainsaw Massacre 3.
come on in. I got some coffee for you to sit down. Incredible. Here we go. From Reuters. A program meant to help developing nations. I can't stop laughing. A program meant to help developing nations fight climate change is funneling billions of dollars back to rich countries. You don't say. Japan, France, Germany, U.S., other wealthy nations are reaping billions of dollars in economic awards from a global program meant to help the developing world grapple with the effects of climate change. By channeling money from the program back into their own pockets, wealthy countries contradict the widely embraced concept that they should compensate poor ones for their long-term pollution that fueled climate change. So the program is, listen, we're sorry, we've polluted your environment, here's a program, and it ends up ripping off the victim. So here are the numbers. Wealthy nations have loaned at least $18 billion at market rate interest. That is not the norm for loans for climate-related and other aid projects, which usually carry low or no interest. At least another $11 billion in loans, nearly all from Japan, required recipient nations to hire or purchase materials from companies in the lending countries. So then they reach out to one person for her point of view, and she says, from a justice perspective, that's just deeply reprehensible. Are you kidding me? I mean, how cynical can you be to, like, pump these programs? You need to help your climate, you need to help your environment, and then it's just a scam.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'll talk about it more later, but I've been reading this book on private equity. And one of the things they're very clear about is how private equity has really targeted companies that serve poor people and how it's basically extracting assets from the poor. It's astonishing.
We saw that in a Dollar General story a few weeks back.
Perfect example.
Put one price on the shelf, add a dollar at the register, no one... But they won't even notice half the time. Yep.
They're noticing. They're now noticing. I just have to say, looking at that picture, in 2019, I spent a couple weeks in Thailand. And I have a friend who runs an Echo. She has an Echo resort village, and it's a beautiful resort. And we would walk down to the Bay of Thailand, and we would talk, walking up and down and discuss geopolitics, what's going on in the world, walking down, back and down along the beach because it was so hot. So you want to stay cool and you just walk along the beach back and forth. And after several days of walking back and forth, she said to me, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, walking back and forth in this beach. Yeah. And I've never seen the level of water change an inch in 20 years. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because I've traveled all over the world a lot in the last 10 years. And I've never found a place anywhere in the world where the level of the sea has changed at all. And she said, neither have I. And I said, well, I don't know what this climate change is, but.
Yeah. It's a banker scam. Anytime a banker shows up, like, I'm here to help you with science. You know, I got a guy in a beaker there told me, don't listen.
The one place you will see something real is the glaciers in Switzerland are receding. And the Swiss are in a state of complete grief about it.
Wow.
And so that's the one place where you will see something that, you know, and they believe it's climate change. So,
okay.
That's the one place.
Be my guest. Okay. Anyway, but that's just a scam.
Right.
But it's another one where you can spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And the rockets have great throughput.
Right. At least with nuclear power plants, people are like, well, you know, at least I got power coming out of my outlet. Climate change, what's the product? What's your deliverable? A report?
Let me just ask you something. You know, so I'm just brainstorming here. If a company, a private company receives a $1.5 billion loan and you set up a contract mechanism between that company and the Department of Energy and the U.S. government, who's not subject to all the financial management rules or laws, that company is also operating in the Ukraine. Now, do we think any of that money is going to make its way into the Ukraine?
Why would it? You know, you have the devil's in the details.
Right.
Show me the contract between the DOE and the company.
Right.
And I'll give you an idea of how much money made it.
Right.
It all depends on what does the company have to deliver to the government, right? Because that'll tell you what they can get away with.
Right.
Anyway, let's keep it going. Let's just shift gears to space military global turf wars. This next story didn't really raise any eyebrows. Like, what? Look at this. Russian Navy vessels to dock in Havana, Cuba. To dock in Havana, Cuba insists there's no threat. The U.S. insists there's no threat, too. Four Russian vessels, including a nuclear-powered submarine, will arrive in Havana next week, Cuban officials have said. It's an unusual deployment of powerful nuclear submarine Kazan and three other naval vessels so close to the U.S. comes amid major tensions over the war in Ukraine. Putin suggested this week that Moscow could take asymmetrical steps if Western countries like Germany and the U.S. were to supply Ukraine with weapons that were then used on Russian soil. So that's a pretty serious backdrop going on for these nuclear subs to show up. But here you go. U.S. officials told reporters Wednesday that Russia had plans to send combat vessels into the Caribbean region in order to conduct naval exercises, noting that while Washington did not see their arrival as threatening, the U.S. would monitor their exercises. What's going on there?
Well, two comments on that. I just think Putin's sending a message saying two can play this game.
I think that's okay. Right. Yeah.
But I will tell you another little factoid. The beginning of the U.S. dollar as not as a reserve currency, but sharing reserve currency status with the pound started when the U.S. got control of the sea lanes in the Caribbean.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's one thing to let China take over the sea lanes in the South China Sea. It's another thing to share control of the sea lanes in the Caribbean with the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons the story hadn't gotten any play is that Putin's not doing anything here in the Caribbean that we're not doing in over in Ukraine.
Right.
Ourselves.
And, of course, the question is, do we want military in Sweden because we want to be closer to the sea lanes and what's going on in the North Pole?
Good question.
Right.
Very, very good question.
Trump wanted Greenland, yeah. But we'll take Sweden instead.
Sweden's close enough. Yeah.
Right.
Sweden, Norway, Finland. Yeah, they're far enough.
Right. Sweden doesn't have, you know, oceanfront property because Finland and Norway cut them off in the north. But it's still, and of course you've got mountain range in Sweden from which you can see a lot.
Interesting.
High ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right. It's tit for tat going on here. And that's why it's not played up, because it would draw into question what we're doing to Ukraine exactly. Okay, let's turn to Pepe Escobar and get his take on what happened in St. Petersburg. There was a big meeting of the BRICS Plus. Three key messages from St. Petersburg to the global majority. Okay, here are the message number one. As the collective West launched total economic war against Russia, the civilization state turned it around and positioned itself as the world's fourth largest economy by purchasing power parity. That's number one. And so what the U.S. response to that I just read this morning, we're doubling down on sanctions. But Russia, the sanctions didn't work. Russia's now a lot more powerful. Message number two, BRICS are working on their own payment infrastructure, independent from pressure sanctions by the collective West. An apolitical, I'll talk about this in a minute, apolitical transactional form of cross-border payments anchored in gold, 40%, and BRICS plus currency, 60%. So they're totally on board for CBDC, full speed ahead. Apolitical means you, surf on the ground, don't have any say over what the central bankers are doing. That's what apolitical means. Message number three. No less than 59 nations and counting plan to join not only BRICS, but also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, and the Eurasia Economic Union. So they're all on board for recreating the EU, just the BRICS version of it. Right. Isn't that great? So that you and the BRICS nations, too, can lose your sovereignty just like they did in Europe. How'd that work out for
right.
Europe?
But they are trying to create trade liquidity and credit capacity outside of the traditional Western G7, G20 framework. So they are trying to build resiliency.
Yes, but yeah. Remember, gold backing means that it's this is another debt-based scheme.
Yeah. you're in the central bank short squeeze.
Yeah, you're in a central bank short squeeze. And when, by the way, that interesting that gold would be 40% and other currencies would be 60%. What role are those other currencies going to play, pray tell, when your version of CBDC from the whole union over there becomes the currency?
I think they've been doing swap lines since the 90s together and trying to build that capacity. So I think they are going to try and do much more trade settlement between each other in their own currencies. So I think that's legitimate.
Okay. Yeah. So the regional currencies, the country by country currencies, will be maintained, but they'll have this super duper CBDC union currency too?
We don't know. The CBDC could just be for retail. We don't know.
Could be just for wholesale. I don't know
yeah,
either.
We don't know.
But they're on board for CBDC.
Absolutely.
And that word apolitical, that means your legislature does not have a say.
Right.
In what the central bank is doing.
Well, we know CBDC ultimately replaces the legislature and executive branch.
We'll get to that notion Hey Robot when we get to Saudi Arabia. Anyway, let's keep it going. It's Space Military Global Turf Wars with Macron. Our guy, what happened? Emmanuel? Holy cow, from PBS, Macron dissolved France's National Assembly, called snap elections after defeat in EU vote. He dissolved the lower house of France's parliament in a surprise announcement, sending voters back to the polls in the coming weeks to choose lawmakers. After his party was handed a humbling defeat by the far right in the European election Sunday, how bad was it? Well, Marine Le Pen's anti-immigration Nationalist Party was estimated to get around 31 to 32% of the votes, a historic result, more than double the share of Macron's Renaissance Party, which was projected to reach around 15%.
Right.
That's terrible.
So let's look at the European Parliament. So that's those numbers are for the European Parliament. If you look domestically, the Renaissance Party, which is Macron's party, has 159 seats. But if you look at Le Pen, she's got 88, and the Republicans, which is the other big independent party, the combination have 147. So they're only 12 behind Macron. And it's a no-brainer if he calls for new legislative elections, which is, I think it's June 30 and July 7th, then they're going to surpass the Renaissance Party in the legislature.
Yeah.
Now, Macron's got three more years on his term. But if you look at what has happened, so he dissolved the lower parliament. I don't know if that gives him more power for the next 30 days. But what I will say is what we saw in the Netherlands is the populist candidate won. And what we ended up with was not some real change person running the country. The new guy is a civil servant who's the former head of the intelligence agency.
Wow.
You know, so more power to NATO, more power to the war plan.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the question is, are we just going to see sort of neocon obedient people popping up in every one of these countries, supposedly after a populist revolt?
That is a great question.
Yeah.
You know, Mearsheimer said the forces of nationalism are coming, and he's right. But that's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, but if we look at what the rumors are, and it's just rumors now, but the rumors out of France and the Netherlands is we're basically seeing neocon-friendly people moved up into power, you know, and that's what's really happening. So we'll just have to see what happens. But
we are seeing the classic globalist getting the boot big time.
They're getting the boot.
And that happened big time in Belgium. And I want to run this clip to show you how bad it is. There's no words in this clip. It's all body language of the Belgian PM, Prime Minister, resigning after
5.9%.
5.9%. Let's the tears are just too delicious to not watch. Look at this. So sad. It's crushed. Those guys, I think they're stunned that the voters would do this.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Poodles not doing well at the polls.
Not doing well at the polls. Poodles are getting, they're getting roundly rejected at the polls.
Right.
Okay. Let's go to the story we're talking about with Saudi Arabia and CBDC as we move to Hey Robot. Another example of know who your friends are. Find out who your friends are. Here we go from Al Monitor. Not really sure what it is. Coverage in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia joins China and United Arab Emirates in digital currency project. The Bank for International Settlements announced on Wednesday that Saudi Arabia is joining Project Mbridge as a full participant. The project explores multi-central bank digital currency platform to enable cross-border payments. BIS, Bank for International Settlements, is a financial institution that is owned by its member central bank. So as a reminder, commercial banks own the central banks, and now we just find out central banks own the BIS. So private banks own central banks own BIS.
But you want to ask the question, who owns those private banks?
Who do you think? Okay.
Right.
The bank's goal is to support cooperation between central banks. So that cooperation, we should change that, what it is, really manipulation, collusion between central banks and serve as a bank for the central bank. That's, yeah, okay, that's taken a, that's a stretch, but I'll take it. Work on Project Mbridge began in 2021 via collaboration between BIS, the Central Bank of the United Arab Emirates, the People's Bank of China, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, and the Bank of Thailand. Okay, none of these banks has any transparency whatsoever. None of these banks is democratically run. They're just classic banks.
Now, I'm assuming that the Mbridge enjoys the sovereign immunity of the BIS. I don't know that, but I'm assuming.
If the BIS is involved, yeah, it's run out of the BIS.
Right.
Okay, let me back up. The reason the BIS is so private is that BIS has a headquarters agreement with Switzerland because the BIS is headquartered in Basel, Switzerland. The immunities agreement, the headquarters agreement says, basically, BIS is a sovereign entity within the borders of Switzerland. You can't subpoena our documents. You can't arrest our officials. We don't pay taxes. You know, you don't mess with us. You
right,
can't
but we
get
can
to
also
us.
Hold and transfer funds secretly with no disclosure.
Of course not. You can, how are you going to? We're not going to disclose it voluntarily, and you're not going to get it via subpoena.
Right.
Inviolable is the term they use.
Right.
The same is true of the ECB. The ECB has a headquarters agreement with Germany.
Right.
It basically says this bank here, you don't reach us. You can't subpoena our documents. You can't get our archives. You can't get our computer drives. You can't get anything. Get out.
Right.
You can't arrest us. Nothing. We're immune.
Right.
So it's complete secrecy. These banks operate in total secrecy. So back to this story with the BIS and China and the UAE and Saudi Arabia. That this is a it's total opacity.
Right. It's an announcement to say we're building an entirely global secret system.
Yes.
To run all the money and
yes,
completely outside your law.
Right.
Right. This is a breakaway civilization.
Your national laws are out the window. Totally right. Out the window.
Right.
We're the overseer of this whole thing. And we're gonna run it in total secrecy.
Right. And the guys with the big oil fields just joined us.
Right. You got it.
Right. Which is why you may want to bring back some of your nuclear plants.
I say this because, as you know, I'm no fan of the Federal Reserve. Right. However, I will take the Federal Reserve over that any old day of the week.
Absolutely.
Because we can get to the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Okay. You can FOIA the Federal Reserve. You think you're going to FOIA China? You think you're going to FOIA the BIS?
Right.
Under what law, pray tell?
Right. Exactly.
You're not going to get anything.
Right. That's why when people say shut down the Fed, you know, so Mike Lee just put in a bill saying, you know, kill the Fed. You know, I had a thing with Massey at Polyface where he said, kill the Fed. I said, no, get the $21 trillion back first.
Yeah.
You know, because if you kill the Fed, they get to keep the $21
trillion. Before you pull out the gun to kill the Fed, tell me who's replacing the Fed.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Anyway, if it's the Treasury and we have transparency in the Treasury, that's one thing. Let's talk.
Right.
But I never hear that. It's always this strange silence of like, well, how do you propose to settle transactions between commercial?
Oh, we'll use gold.
Okay. Yeah, it's going to work. Okay.
I mean, but it's not funny.
It's not funny.
Okay.
So the Fed is bad, but just because the Fed's bad doesn't make BIS your friend.
Oh, no.
Do
BIS,
not make that mistake.
You know, get ready for major depopulation if BIS is in control.
Boy, watch out.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's turn to Farmageddon. This next story is hilarious. So the bird flu, we know how bad bird flu is. They pump it every week. It's jumping from one species to another. There's a case here. We've got to slaughter 10 million chickens. Unbelievable.
But I'll tell you, this story could never have happened 10 years ago. People still respected the empire. People have had it. This is a perfect example of people having it.
So we gotta pump up the bird flu. We gotta make it seem dangerous. Take one. Here we go. Mexico's health secretary denies death of resident due to bird flu subtype. Uh-oh. Trouble in River City. Mexican Health Secretary Jorge Alcocer on Thursday denied an announcement by the WHO that a man's death in Mexico was caused by a strain of bird flu that had never before been found in a human. The health secretary of Mexico rebuffed the WHO's announcement and assured that the 59-year-old man who was reported to have died from the bird flu instead, quote, died from other causes, mainly kidney and respiratory failure, end quote. I can point out that the statement made by the WHO is pretty bad since it speaks of a fatal case of bird flu, which was not the case, he said. So that one just failed. No bird flu deaths.
But I'm telling you, you know, this would never have happened 5 years ago, but I can just see the Mexican health secretary saying, you know, this is too ridiculous to allow to go on in this country. I'm not going along with this ridiculousness.
So the total death toll is zero worldwide, right? They tried to get one in Mexico and they failed. But let's go to Deborah Birx and see what she's got to say.
You know, Meryl Nass just had a headline, I think, on her Substack, 40 million bird flu vaccines are on their way to Europe.
40 million bird flu vaccines?
Wow. Or vials or something. It was 4 million or 40 million, some huge number of bird flu vaccines are being shipped to Europe now as we speak.
Well, let's see what Birx would do. By the way, I don't remember Birx looking like this. Is a video clip of Birx talking about what we need to do. What we need to do about this bird flu threat. Let's take a look at this. Let's listen to what she has to say. What we need to do.
We're not testing to really see how many people have been exposed and got asymptomatically infected. We should be testing every cow weekly. You can do pooled PCR. We have the technology. The great thing about America is we're incredibly innovative and we have the ability to have these breakthroughs. We could be pool testing every dairy worker. I do believe that there's undetected cases in humans because we're once again only tracking people with symptoms. When we did that with COVID, the virus spread throughout the Northeast undetected because it took a long time to get to the vulnerable individuals. But in the meantime, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were infected with asymptomatic or mild disease and never came to medical attention. We have to switch from symptoms to actually definitive laboratory testing. We have the capacity.
Unbelievable. She's hitting all the points. We got to test every cow. We got to test every dairy worker. And don't be fooled by people's lack of symptoms. They could still test positive under our test.
I would love to take Burke up to a ranch in Wyoming and put her out on a ranch and tell her she's got to test every cow, every cattle on that ranch every week. And if not, she's going to get a $5,000 fine.
Yeah.
That's a woman who, I can't tell you what a psychopathic vision that is. If you have any knowledge of what it is right. to be a farmer, rancher dealing with livestock.
But she's just giving talking points, repeating. She doesn't know what she's saying. She's brain dead. She had no idea what she's saying. She's just repeating talking. She had no earthly idea. She had no connection to reality whatsoever.
I don't know. To me, it's proof positive they're trying to destroy all the independent income in the agriculture sector.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
She's an economic hit lady. That's what she is.
Big, right. big time. Big right. time. She's got her hit list and that's it. Don't worry about no symptoms, you know? Anyway, let's keep it going. This next story from the Defender. The dam has broken. Oh, really? Mainstream media reports on study showing COVID vaccines likely fueled rise in excess deaths. So there's two different things here. There's mainstream media and then there's study. Reports on a study. There's actually a couple studies in this story. Excess death data from 47 countries in the Western world show that excess mortality has remained high for the last three consecutive years, despite COVID-19 lockdown measures and COVID-19 vaccines, concluded the authors of a peer-reviewed study. So the excess mortality is up, but it could be lockdowns or it could be vaccines. We just don't know. In addition to presenting excess deaths figures, this Dutch study cited research showing negative health outcomes related to COVID-19 vaccination programs and lockdown measures. So again, the negative health outcomes could be vaccines, could be lockdowns. We just don't know. That's the Dutch study. There's also a Norway study of excess mortality, and they come to a conclusion. They just come right out and say it. From the data available to us, it was not possible to compare excess mortality in vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. They said, well, that's a critical failure. You have to know the difference, otherwise you can't conclude that it's the vaccine, can you? So what are we talking about here? Well, what we're talking about here is the Telegraph. This is the mainstream media report that the Defender is talking about. It's a prominent mainstream UK paper, ran a front page article on the study headline with the headline, COVID vaccine may have helped fuel rise in excess deaths. So that's the only place where the COVID vaccine is being connected to the rise of excess deaths. And there, even there, it's May. And then Merrill Nass, the inevitable Merrill Nass, posted a photo of the article on Substack saying the dam is broken. Sorry, but those studies don't say that.
Well, Rasmussen poll, which came out, I think, last month, said nearly one out of five Americans know somebody who was killed by the COVID injection.
Right.
Now,
I don't doubt that, but these studies, that article is just a mess, because it's like, well, the studies don't say that. The Telegraph says that. Yeah.
Right. But here's what's happening, and you see it in many different places. And I should note, Denny Rancor is just now revising his numbers on excess death. So I was just on Doctors for COVID Ethics, and we're trying to figure out what the numbers of estimated dead and disabled are, you know, so maybe if when Denny finishes, we'll have better numbers. But what we are seeing is an enormous shift in the mainstream media and social media about recognizing that there's a problem.
Yeah.
Now, the question is why? What's this about?
Right.
You know, so we saw, for example, the German military quietly drop their COVID injection mandate. And I'm assuming it is, if you want to send real soldiers to Ukraine, you need them not to have myocarditis. I'm assuming that's why.
Yeah.
But there is a shift. And the question is, what are they up to? I don't know.
I don't know. But we got to get to the truth. And, you know, I got my hunches that if I could look at the data, I could probably see that, yeah, the excess deaths are coming from the vaccine. But the authors of these studies, for whatever reason, aren't willing to pull the trigger on that conclusion, right? In other words, you saw that one, the Norway one, saying, well,
right.
we were unable to compare excess deaths in the vaccinated with excess deaths in the unvaccinated. I mean, if the excess deaths are higher in the vaccinated, and then you find out, well, they're just as high, just as much higher right. in the unvaccinated. Well, what the hell? You know, right. We have to find out that the truth has to be the number one goal here, not politics, not, you know, damn those vaccines. We're going to get them at all costs. Not at the cost of the truth.
Yeah,
not
but
on my
I'm
watch.
Coming back. I'm coming back to liability because we know enough to know that a vaccine program was begun and operated knowing that it would lead to enormous amounts of poisoning and death. They knew.
Fair enough.
They knew. They lied about what was in this stuff.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. What's your number one document on that point? Every litigator, you got a case, you got a stack of your 10 best I got you documents. What's your best document on
I would have
knew
to go back and look, but I would say some of what, because I never read the documents, but some of what was reported to be in the Pfizer documents as to what Pfizer knew from the trials.
Could be.
Right.
Could
That's
be.
My well, guess we, is what the best was.
Yeah. But to me, hammering the story about the Telegraph, okay, it's in the mainstream media now. But what if the media is wrong?
Well, but here's my question, John, because and now I'm talking about the court of popular opinion. I'm not talking about litigation.
Right.
You had the government and the medical establishment poison millions of Americans. And now hundreds of thousands of people are dead and millions of people are disabled and families are bankrupted or harmed economically. And that's a fact. And we have good reason to believe that we knew. I mean, if I knew in April, 2020, under no circumstance to take the injection, I mean, many people knew and they went for it and did it anyway. Okay.
I know.
Now that's murder, right? That's a taking. That's murder. That's whatever crimes you want to call it. But
I know from my point of view, you're asking me to inject an undisclosed substance provided to me by an admitted felon
right.
into my body. The answer is no.
Right. Okay. So you knew that then. A lot of people didn't know what you knew and they did, they went forward. You know, to me in that, and again, I'm talking popular opinion, there is a crime. And that crime has not been faced by the full body politic. And if you look at the speed that people are getting, fast acting cancer or other diseases, there's a good chance right. they're going to figure it out.
Right. Right. We need to figure it out. And we need doctors and we need people writing studies who are willing to state their conclusions in plain language. And not hide behind, well, we couldn't find this, we couldn't find that, it could be this, maybe the other. Anyway, my concern over that story is you have a publication like the Telegraph coming out and saying things that don't appear to be true about those two studies. They're saying, oh, well, excess deaths, of course, they say that they hide behind the word may. Maybe those excess deaths are due to vaccines. But if a publication like the Telegraph comes out and says excess deaths due to vaccines, look at these studies, and the studies don't say that, what do you think is going to happen to the Telegraph under the climate of laws about mis and disinformation? They're going to get shuttered. That's what's going to happen. You just got to be careful with what you say.
Right. No, I agree. I'm talking about, I'm approaching it from a different avenue, which is, how do you help a society face the reality of what just happened?
I think you start with the dead bodies at the front end of that pandemic, in places that people were murdered in New York and Italy. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
This alleged virus going around, the contours of that virus look remarkably like jurisdictions with names like, New York.
Right.
Or New York City. Right? That's not a virus. That's a political decision to dispatch and kill thousands of people.
Right.
We need to cope with that.
Right.
right? And so how many deaths are you really talking about here? The excess deaths at the front end of that pandemic, to me, look like murders.
We're not.
There's no virus involved at all. No natural causes at all. I mean, there's a certain baseline level of deaths you're going to have anyway, year in and year out, just due to the flu.
Right.
You know, and the excesses I've seen, they follow jurisdictional contours. They're completely murders.
Right.
You know, and so if there really was no danger in the coming from any virus or whatever you wanted, from any kind of pandemic, there never really was any pandemic. Query, why do you need a vaccine to begin with? And what its purpose really was. I think that's where you start.
So getting the truth out on what Andrew Cuomo did in New York would be very helpful.
Did you really need a vaccine? Did you really need any sort of, you know, medical intervention at all to begin with?
Right.
Let's answer that question.
Right.
I can't even see that. I don't believe there ever was a pandemic.
No, I don't believe there was either.
No. I think the whole thing was
hype. I do believe things happen to engineer death.
I think the things ended up
right.
to engineer death and to engineer death counts
right.
and to engineer cases
right.
and to engineer the gaming of statistics through financial rewards. I think all that was in play.
Right.
But we need to get to the bottom of that. And I think that by attacking, they're trying to attack vaccines in this article. They're coming at it from the weakest point, which is you're relying on people from the medical establishment writing studies to make your case for you? What's wrong with you?
I don't know. We keep re-embracing the felons.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. Right.
Okay. Another case of improprieties with the pharmaceutical industry is this next clip from RT. This is crazy. It's like the graft is in your face. What's the defense here? Anyway, this is from RT.
Facebook's independent fact checker may not be so independent after all. A US congressman has questioned the impartiality of factcheck.org, which is supposed to tackle vaccine disinformation because it's indirectly funded by jab manufacturer Johnson & Johnson.
Who pays the paychecks of the fact checkers? The vaccine fact checkers at factcheck.org, who claim to be independent, are funded by an organization that holds over $1.8 billion of stocks in a vaccine company and is run by a former director of the Centers for Disease Control.
The fact-checking account responded to the accusations by making clear its funding sources. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, one of the benefactors, and holds billions in Johnson & Johnson stock. The foundation's CEO is Richard Besser, who was a former acting director of the Center for Disease Control. But factcheck.org claims there's no interference in its editorial decisions, and the foundation's views aren't necessarily reflected in its decisions. But author and liberal studies expert Michael Rechtenwald believes such connections pose risks to the public.
This is absolute collusion on the part of vaccine manufacturers having funding the fact checkers on social media. So we're actually getting to the point where people's lives are being endangered. We've lost all confidence in the social media and our mainstream media entirely. Anything that comes into contradiction with the leftist agenda is deemed misinformation. People are now not able to get information about what's best for their health, including the detriments of the vaccine.
Wow. So if the fact check's answer to this is, well, we're upfront about the graft, so there's no problem. We're funded by Johnson & Johnson, but we tell you that on our webpage. So what are you complaining about?
I don't know what to tell you. You know, we're watching a lot more investigation of where the money's really coming from and getting into people's portfolio. That's a big change now, but more and more people are getting educated about the fact. I don't know if you remember the story about the guys out in the Berkshire Hathaway meeting who called out Buffett because he's essentially financing, you know, the woke stuff. It was pretty funny. And he gets kicked out of the meeting and arrested, right? But, you know, people can start, you know, they're digging and they're researching how the money works. And, you know, you can thank Larry Fink and BlackRock for that because he's got everybody digging in and looking at the stock market portfolios for all the players.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the fact checker to me, you know, they come out, they were ready to pounce on people about the vaccines. Anybody with any sort of questions was fact-checked. And it turns out they're being fact-checked by the pharmaceutical industry itself.
Right.
But it's promoted under this false, deceptive, deceitful, you know, heading of factcheck.org. Like, it's just right. independent fact-checkers. You know, these people are wrong.
Right.
Says the wolf to the sheep. Shameful. Okay.
It is shameful.
Let's go to some less shameful behavior. Let's go to pushback from the firearms industry. I love this. NSSF applauds Alabama Governor Kay Ivey for signing Second Amendment Financial Privacy Act. NSSF is the Firearm Industry Trade Association. They're happy that she passed this law. The law prohibits financial institutions from requiring the use of a firearm code known as a merchant category code from being assigned to firearm and ammunition purchases at retail when using a credit card. The law also, the second thing here, it forbids discriminating against a firearm retailer as a result of the assigned or non-assignment of a firearm code and disclosing the protected financial information. The third thing, and I think they're a little risky here, the law prohibits keeping or causing to be kept any list, record, or registry of private firearm ownership. I'm not sure what the law is there, but for sure that's great pushback because that code is no good.
Right. And it's funny because when the firearms is one of the areas where people are beginning to understand how dangerous financial control is and you know, putting smart contracts on your financial transactions and messing with what you can and cannot buy, even if it's just surveillance and disclosure. So it's good to see the states move this way because they're starting to move against financial transaction control. What was interesting about this article, I didn't know, was this was Andrew Sorkin's idea.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I love more than seeing Andrew Sorkin get his head handed to him.
You talk about a poodle working on behalf of the criminals in charge. That's Andrew Sorkin.
Ugh.
Boy, he's a reliable water carrier at the New York Times.
Right.
Yeah.
So Andrew Sorkin got his head handed to it. Good for them.
The reason I'm raised some concern about the law prohibiting or keeping or causing to be kept any list of prior private firearm ownership is, you know, laws have a way of they get passed and then misused. And you don't want to see that. And the way I could see that law being misused is you have a gun club, you keep a list of members. And you get hammered by this law. You kept a list of private firearm ownership. And you say, well, that's not the intent of it. The intent of it is to harm, you know, the intent is
that's a good point.
To choke back retailers. Like, yeah, but the law may not be written that way. Again, the devil's in the details.
Right.
But the first two points are good for sure. That code is no good. Everybody knows that. But the devil's in the details. So,
yeah, you got to make sure it doesn't apply to. You know,
you can't go too far. If your law is good, it's well-meaning, and it gets held unconstitutional or worse, as might be the case there, applied against the very people you want to protect.
Right.
You know, you haven't done anybody any favors.
Right.
You know? Okay, let's go to pushback back to Palestine, circling back to Gaza that we started out the top of the show with. Let's circle back. Mapping which countries recognize Palestine in 2024. Okay. So here's the global map. Take a look at that. And you can see that it's really most of the world. It's 146 countries around the world. The reason this is timely now is that Norway, Ireland, and Spain recently formally recognized Palestine as a state. At the moment, in addition to Norway, Ireland, and Spain, 9 other European countries recognize Palestine. So here's the number. 143 of 193 members of the United Nations General Assembly voted in favor of Palestine joining the UN, something only states can do. So you see it right there. You've got 143 states saying, yeah, Palestine should be recognized as a state, and 47 other countries, including the US and most of Europe, saying, nope, they should not. But most of the world is behind Palestine.
Had no idea that many countries had recognized Palestine until I read this article.
I was amazed too. Yes.
I was amazed. So, we're
that much of an outlier.
Right. So back to Israel being in trouble. I don't see how they get out of this without a two-state solution.
Yeah, and given Israel's tendencies, you know, is a two-state solution going to work? But I think you're right. Israel's in trouble.
Right. They're in trouble.
I mean, you're losing prominent members of Europe now, Israel.
Right. Yeah, Norway, you know, is a very consequential loss.
Just the WHO is losing Mexico.
Right.
Mexico is the birthplace of August and Carstens. Okay. You lose Mexico, you got a problem on your hands.
I can't fathom how the current, if you look at the current cabinet, that group of people can't get out of this. So something has to happen that they, you know, that they lose control. You're going to need a whole new kind of leadership to
That's the one area of the world I can't tell you. I can't even give you a guess on how that shakes out. You got me. I don't know. I can tell you how Ukraine's going to shake out, probably. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. You've got a war cabinet that is 100% dependent on the empire.
Yes.
So you tell me who's going to run the empire and what are they going to want?
Right now, it looks like Trump is going to be running the empire.
Right. So he's going to help the guys in the current cabinet.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like, but who knows?
Right.
That's it for the stories, and which brings us to charts.
Yep. So okay. I just, you know, looking at the colonization of Sweden, well, first let's look at the European Parliament. We just quickly. Yeah. So this is after the election. And, right. You know, what you can see the net change. So real drop in the, you know, what did you call them? The liberal globalists?
Yeah. The your garden variety globalists, Renew Europe, Green Alliance, they're losing big time. And then non-attached also lost here. And then your winner, the European People's Party. So you're right. Yeah. It's styled as a populist movement.
Yeah, but I think we have to see how it shakes out to see how it really works. Now, remember, the European Parliament doesn't have a lot of power. Its power is to bring transparency to things. So
yeah.
I don't see this as a major, major power shift. But what the vote does is it does reflect the fact that people are angry and they're... You know, the old spin isn't working. So so let's turn to, we have two stock charts. I wanted to take a look, given the colonization of Europe.
Oh, this chart.
I wanted to start with the going direct reset in August 2019 when the vote happens.
Right.
And how much both the U.S. and private equity has been advantaged relative to Europe. Because if you talk to an investment advisor before that meeting, they would have said, okay, the U.S. market has significantly outperformed Europe, and now we're going to see the worm turn and Europe outperform the U.S., but that's not what happened. U.S. significantly outperformed Europe, and so let's just take a look at this one. So we see the top line is KKR, which I just used for private equity, one of the largest private equity firms in the world. On the S&P, SPX is S&P at 83%. So right. The broad U.S. stock market is trading at 83. The private equity, one of the leaders, is trading way above that. And that's important, John, because remember, one of the things we've seen for the last 10 years is more and more companies go private or finance privately, and the number of companies on the U.S. stock market shrinking. You know, private equity is sort of taking over. So we see that dynamic. But then we see France and Germany, France ahead 35%, less than half of what the S&P is doing. And then Germany only 18%. And then, of course, China down 32%.
That's the stunner.
Right. And so what we're seeing is the equity interests in the United States clearly advantaged by the going direct reset.
Clearly advantage by the going direct reset.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Why the disparity between the S&P, that gap itself is 83% versus minus 32%.
Right.
100% so difference.
When $5 trillion got injected, who got the benefit of that?
I guess the people with stocks.
Well, you shut down Main Street and move all the market share into publicly traded stocks. Thank you, Andrew Sorkin. Yeah. What happens? Right. Yeah. What happens?
I don't know.
Right. Okay. So I just wanted to look at that with Sweden. So we did another chart where same chart. So the S&P, KKR, and Sweden, a little bit ahead of France and Germany. But, you know, here's the problem. When you study what has happened in the Ukraine, you say, you know, yes, is Biden incompetent? But in my experience, Mr. Global is not incompetent.
Right.
And what I see is the empire moving in, depopulating the Ukraine and colonizing Europe. And I have to say it's working.
Yeah.
I mean, if you follow the money, the U.S. is winning at the expense of Europe. It's a consolidation. It's a colonization. Now, they're certainly losing vis-a-vis Russia. And they were hoping that Russia would collapse or do regime change.
You know, that's in corporate terms, that's funny. Colonization, another way, in corporate terms, if you looked at the countries as brands, if you looked at the U.S. as a brand and Europe as a brand, but the empire is the provider of the brands under that umbrella, this would be called cannibalization.
Right.
So your Coke, you know, and you're selling way more Coke, but it's coming to the expense of something else you make.
Right.
Diet Coke, cannibalization.
Let me point out one of the Anglo-American Alliance's big problems, the grand chessboard issue, was Asia rises as the manufacturing juggernaut. The European market is the biggest consumer market in the world, the European Union, not the United States, right?
Right.
Now, if the U.S. Army is going to now even significantly increase its presence in the European Union, who's going to get that market?
The U.S.
We shall see. All I'm saying is the U.S., the going direct reset is the United States is consolidating its control over the Western world, you know, to keep itself going.
Yeah.
And I hate to say this, it's not just the European population, it's the U.S. population too.
You know, and we're in spitting distance from five years this has been going on.
Well, but if you look at the rise of KKR and you read the story of how private equity has been making money, you know, it's making money in ways that liquidate the tax base and reduce, you know, destroy and wipe out the middle class.
Right.
So, you know, that's a story of colonization, but it's one where, you know, if you look forward to what's going to happen to the G7 populations next year, in the U.S. and Europe, you know, we're on the menu. We are on the menu. Right.
Big time.
Right.
That's true pretty much everywhere. We saw that in the story of Israel. It's the small businesses around the world that are taking the brunt of this.
Right.
And it's been going on for 5 years.
Right.
You know? Okay. Right.
How are we going to turn the tide on the oligarchs? That's the question.
You gotta get angry. You gotta hold your feet to the fire.
Right.
That's what you gotta do. You gotta keep the pressure up. Yep.
Okay. So speaking of which, let's turn to in-house at Solari.
Here you go.
One question we've gotten a lot of since Jennifer Walters came to run that health series is to how do I do testing? I don't trust the hospitals. I don't trust the doctors. How do I do my own testing? How do I get testing? And so Jennifer put together a roundtable on diagnostic testing with a group. Tom Cohen and his son Asher have put together a new biology clinic. It's basically a concierge service for, you know, for family health that he and a group of naturopathic doctors are doing. Anyway, they had a great roundtable and go through all the different ways to do diagnostic testing in this environment. So a very practical, useful information. And Jennifer has always did a fabulous job. Very interesting.
That's a great topic. I've wondered about some home testing myself, and to see that, I have to take a look at that. I just don't know. There's got to be a way to test yourself without going
on. Yeah, we're trying to balance between the weekly interview, between what's really going on in the world, like David Hughes and, you know, all the control techniques, with practical things like your car insurance and diagnostic testing. So
yeah,
balance between macro and micro, if you will.
That's great. Okay, yeah. Let's keep it going with Ask Catherine.
Okay, I just want to give everybody a heads up who has a surprising number of people listen to Ask Catherine. We're reorganizing it in the Building Wealth Framework. We had a huge number of questions last week, and I finally said, wait, this is too scattered. So we're going to reorganize it into the 6 tracks of Building Wealth and then recommended links. So I'm just giving you a heads up that that's coming.
Okay.
And then the next one is, okay, I want everybody to really pay attention to me on this because I'm going to give you a prediction. The amount of internet and cyber crime and identity fraud crime is on the rise. And I think it's going to continue to be on the rise. And I decided I would use a new action film as the movie of the week because it has a couple of scenes where you see how these operations work and how sophisticated they are and how much money they put into sort of corporatizing crime in this way. And it starts off with a woman who's a friend of the hero, who's a retired covert operator. And his neighbor is hit by a phishing scheme, and she loses all of her savings and bank accounts. Basically is, you know, stripped of all her retirement savings by one of these phishing operations. And it turns out this operation has been financing the new president in the United States. So it goes all the way to the top. That's how it gets very interesting. But I wanted you to see an example of how some of these operations work because Bob Sullivan, who's one of my favorite people on retail financial fraud, just came out with a new story in his Substack of a really frightening new round of very sophisticated crime. And I put a link to the Red Tape Chronicles, which is his Substack in the story. And you can link to it here, but I'm going to interview him next week. We'll have a weekly interview on the Solari Report about the do's and don'ts of protecting yourself against this kind of crime. But I think it's really on the rise and you can't be too careful about who you talk to on the phone or who you communicate with on the internet. You really need to be very, very careful. So just big warning, this is on the rise and they can strip a lot of people of a lot of money.
Yeah. And also this movie's got Jason Statham. He's great.
I love action movies, so I really liked it. It was a fascinating story. And Jeremy Irons plays the former head of the CIA, and he's great. So you got some good acting.
All right. And next up, Food for the Soul, Impressionist 1874.
Yeah, so Nina goes back and takes a look at Renoir and the different Impressionists and how it all got started. It's fun, as always.
Okay. And we go back. We have Hero of the Week returns.
So because the IHR amendments had such a difficult time and got watered down, we thought we would do the anti-WHO crew. So we picked 6 of the leaders who've really beaten the WHO back tremendously. And we just were very, very grateful. And so we put that up. And it's funny because I'm reminded there's a great scene in the movie Patton where Bradley says about Patton, he's got another headline of George, you know, he says, give George a headline and he's good for another 60 miles. So sometimes, you know, if you look at how hard these folks, they've been working very, very hard and just, you know, for a year. And sometimes just saying thank you makes a big difference. So, yeah. We put up a new, I don't know if you saw this, we put up a new little audio underneath the graphic.
Yeah, I saw that.
And if you play it, it's the sound of applause. It's sort of a Mardi Gras applause.
Saw that graphic.
Yeah. And then finally, I wanted to do this last week. The AI, the new AI magazine, here it is, has mailed. And it's very important if you're a print plus digital subscriber, please make sure that you've received it by the end of next week. You should have it now. Most people have received it this week, but I want to make sure if you don't get it this week or next week, you let us know because there are more and more problems with the mail. And of course, it's at the store. So if you're not a print plus digital subscriber, you may want to go to the store and get a copy if you like hard copy. If not, just print out you know, print out the digital. You can print out the PDF or read it online. Okay, right. I think that's it for the week.
That's it. Yep.
Okay.
We will see you next week with another, I'm sure, crazy slate of headlines.
Right. So just remember, the theme was find out who your friends are.
Yeah.
You know, and be careful. You know, I hate to sound like my mother, but now is the time to be careful of strangers, right?
Yeah.
Make sure you do your due diligence before letting anybody into your computer or your life.
Yeah. And with people in organizations, check your assumptions at the door.
Right. Right. Okay, John, thanks for a great week. You have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you next week.
See you next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solaria Report.